This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Our first plenary session today is on the theme of the state of the party. We're going to be addressing some of the issues around the renewal and refounding of our party, party organisation, party policy, and our political fortunes. And we have an excellent panel of four, the first of whom I shall now invite to speak to us to open this session. I'm delighted to introduce Caroline Flint. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Stephen. It is a welcome opportunity to reflect on where we are just a few weeks after the local elections. And before we get into that interrogation, let's just remember we did win over 800 seats, and actually 400 of those were from the Tories. Our vote was up 8% on last year. And I have to say, echoing something that Stephen said, considering where we were a year ago, I've just been so impressed by the energy and the enthusiasm and the heart and passion that our members, our councillors, our candidates, our MPs and MEPs, and our staff in the party, with support from the trade unions, have put into our efforts over the last 12 months. You know, it's hard when you lose elections. Picking yourself up to carry on and do your best isn't easy. But one thing's for sure, we've come out of these elections with, yes, more challenges ahead, but certainly I think with a party that is up for that fight. I know, going around the country, that in many cases, you know, we did see great wins, but there is more to do. And these local elections were just a step forward. For me, the most important lesson they reveal for Labour is that the collapse of the Liberal Democrat support is just not enough for us to win the next election. We shored up our base in our heartlands, and in many cases, including in my own part of South Yorkshire, that was partly by Labour voters who flirted with the Liberal Democrats in the general election coming home. And that is welcome. We should welcome that they felt they could come home. We also made progress in target seats like Gravesham, and we got a toehold in places that haven't seen a Labour council in years. So, Guildford friends out there, well done for that. But we know that Liberal Democrat votes, welcome as they are, especially in the East, the South East and the South West, to be honest, getting a Tory vote is worth twice as much to us. There are only a certain number of gains we can make from the Lib Dems, and their demise on the 5th of May reminds us that to win the next general election, we have to regain the trust of people who voted Tory in 2010. My second point, regaining the votes of Tories means we have to reach out before beyond our traditional heartlands and into the south, the suburbs and the shires. That's why the county elections in 2013 are so important for us. No government can hope to gain office without a large swathe of MPs across the south. May 2011, a step forward, but we do not have 5 years. We have at best 18 months to lay out who we are and what we're about so we can spend the last 2 years up to the general election on a mission to build that relationship and seal the deal. So how do we do that? Thirdly, the challenge is organisational, partly. We showed in many seats we unexpectedly held on to in 2010 that when we target resources effectively and there is a good campaigning MP, we can win. And there was no lack of work on the part of our candidates and party members, even in those areas where the results were not as good as we might have hoped. But in seats where there is no MP, especially in the south, we've got to ensure they have the resources, the support and the organisers they need. And that's why this debate about refounding our party is so important. My bit of advice on that is to recognise, actually, for someone who's been in the party for over 30 years now, that actually there's much we can do, and the rule book allows us to do that. And going around the country, I see the good and the not so good, and often it's very patchy. So one of the questions we should ask ourselves is, given that some parties are campaigning, that some councillors are out campaigning, and some MPs make sure they show leadership on this, why isn't it happening in a more widespread way? And that's something we have to answer before we just rewrite the rule book. Fourth, the main challenge is not organisational, it's political. What is our message for the voters who voted Labour in the past but have abandoned us since? We saw that in some parts of the country, especially in our great northern cities, we were able to tap into a clear sense of injustice that they were being unfairly treated by this government. And although we won in Gravesham and Ipswich, This message didn't work as successfully in key areas like Kent or Essex or anywhere much south of Birmingham. We won't inherit government through the failings of the coalition. We have to earn the right to govern. And as Ed Miliband will say this afternoon, unless we change, we won't have earned it. So my final point. What is our message? We must continue to be forward-looking, optimistic, but not in a nostalgic Hovis advert way, harking back to some golden age that never existed. Aspirational, but not ducking the main concerns on the minds of hard-working voters. Unafraid to champion middle-class concerns as well as the concerns of those on lower incomes. We should also champion Labour councils that manage their finances well, reward communities that show endeavour, and give people more say over the services they use in their everyday lives. And we have to put ourselves firmly against those who seek to make welfare a lifestyle choice or exploit the immigration system and the generosity of our justice system. Because every successful, radical, reforming Labour government has been the product of broad coalitions across classes, able to speak to the whole country, not just one section of it. Under Ed Miliband's leadership, that is what we will continue to do.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. Our second panellist is Mary Riddell, who is a columnist with the Daily Telegraph and a regular on Progress panels. Please give a warm welcome to Mary.
Thank you very much. The coalition is in disarray. Several cabinet ministers may not survive the difficulties in which they're embroiled. Indeed, to read some media reports, you'd think that David Cameron wouldn't have a cabinet left by the end of next week. The economy is flatlining. So the question is, why isn't Labour doing better? These haven't been a good few weeks. As we've heard from Stephen and from Caroline, there's been a disaster in Scotland. The English council election results are somewhere on a spectrum between catastrophic and satisfactory, depending on your point of view. Of course, there are hopeful signs too, but I don't think we're here primarily to talk about those. Because if Labour seeks refuge in a consoling dialogue between friends, then the party really is in trouble. So what are the issues? One, I think, inevitably, is stuckism. On policy, there's a hiatus while the review continues, and that's quite right. Long-term thinking is essential. At this stage of David Cameron's leadership, he was hugging huskies and the like, something that Ed Miliband has already reiterated this morning that he won't be doing, and a good thing too. But Labour can't afford for that hiatus to become a vacuum. Otherwise, the public will simply switch off. Nor should Labour ever fill the gap with knee-jerk responses. There are times, I think, when the opposition needs to be more measured in its attacks, times such as on NHS reforms, when it needs to be quicker on the kill. There's a visibility problem too. On the doorstep, some of Ed Miliband's messages, I believe, are really, really starting to get through. But people don't feel as if they yet know him. Hence, there is a lack of definition. At a time when the party, instinctively and rightly, is deeply averse to any repeat of the Blair-Brown wars. So far, it's successfully avoided any obvious schisms. But there's a risk, I believe, and that is that discipline gets mistaken for coherence. If I could just take one example, it would be crime, which has been a big issue of the last week. I truly have no idea now where Labour stands. There have been strong indications that the party was moving away from the quite punitive culture of the last government. Prisons, as Ed said this week, said yesterday indeed, are urgently in need of reform. Yet a long period of supporting, with quite proper caveats, what Ken Clark is trying to do, ended somehow in calls for his sacking. Ken Clark has been pretty foolish this week, as I think he would admit in his comments on rape. His prospectus is fiscally driven in part, very far from perfect, as Labour should rightly point out and does. But he's ended up this week garnering some considerable support from commentators of the left. The public have also shown him some backing. What we've seen is a major gaffe by a senior member of the Tory government, with Labour, it appears, somehow ending up as the loser. There's a lesson here, I think, in how populism doesn't equal popularity very often, and how voters rarely conform to the easy stereotype. I think that episode also illustrates something that's about more than crime. It's about the difficulty of attacking a party, a Conservative Party, that has moved with some facility to the centre ground. Whatever people here think, and I would tend to agree on David Cameron's rather bogus big society scheme on the callousness of much of the Tory prospectus, there is no doubt, I think, that in the voters' minds, Cameron is not a prime minister in the mould of old Conservative PMs, and I think Labour perhaps still has to come to terms with that. All that said, there are, I think, some very, very good signs for the future. Ed's article in The Guardian this morning on a national mission strikes absolutely the right note, I think. Labour is never going to limp back to power. And it's still very far, as are other parties of the centre-left across the world, from being able to tell a convincing story of why the world sleepwalked into recession and what happens next. Ed's also right, I think, to square up to Labour's shortcomings in the past, not least on Iraq. But the public won't accept apologies, I don't think, on what has gone wrong, unless they're also convinced by Labour's narrative for the future. That script is beginning to take shape, but we've seen Blue Labour, which has many drawbacks, many holes, and as Caroline says, perhaps a tendency towards the Hovisad school of politics. But it's also developed a theme that links all citizens, rich and poor, and it's mustered storytellers for a party that at one stage spoke the language of the instruction manual. There are many problems ahead, I think, for Labour in this merciless game of presidential politics, something that David Cameron exploits quite well to his advantage. I think it's very heartening that senior figures, Caroline included, are saying explicitly that the party can't rely on George Osborne failing to engineer some economic recovery by the next election. To hope for victory on the back of yet another economic disaster would be death wish politics, and Labour rightly has no wish to indulge in those. But at this time, when there's a gap in specific policies, it's even more important, I think, that people know what are Labour's unshakable principles and irreducible beliefs. I don't think the voters do quite know that yet, and I'm not sure at times that the opposition always knows it either. Thank you.
Mary, thank you very much indeed. One of the big Labour gains earlier this month was Newcastle City Council, and I'm delighted that we have the new Labour leader of Newcastle City Council to speak next, Councillor Nick Forbes. Nick.
Good morning. And Newcastle was, up until 2 weeks ago, one of the Lib Dems' flagship councils in the north. And we had a stunning victory 2 weeks ago. In the general election in 2010, our share of the vote in the city was 39%. This year, it was 52%. There was a 21% swing from the Lib Dems to Labour. We won all of our target seats, but we also won seats in Lib Dem heartlands that we had no expectation of winning. We turned a Lib Dem majority of 6 into a Labour majority of 11. It was a stunning victory for us, and we had a clear manifesto of reform. We had a new generation of candidates in local government. And above all, we put in the hard work. Between January and May, we made contact with more than 20,000 people across the city. And you cannot win without putting in that level of hard work. But I also know that in Newcastle, people were motivated by their sense of anger at cuts and tuition fees and the Lib Dems' role in the government. And my blood ran cold when on the count, One of my colleagues came up to me, really excited as the results were starting to roll in. He said, "Isn't it fantastic? We are now the protest party." And here's the challenge for us. Because the more unpopular the coalition gets, the more people will turn to us in protest. But we can't yet, in all honesty, answer the question, what is Labour for? How do we redefine ourselves in a 21st century globalised society? And as the leader of Newcastle City Council, I see three major challenges for our city that I think also have resonance for Britain. The first is, how do we get our economy growing? For me, it's about creating the next generation of jobs. In our part of the world, that's in wind farm manufacturing, it's in marine technologies, electric vehicles, pharmaceuticals, tourism, culture, the tourism industries and the creative industries, and making sure that people locally have the skills to do those jobs. But we need an economy that is built on the concept of good growth, growth which supports environmental and social objectives, not built on the shifting sands of financial transactions and rising land values. In short, we need an economy built on sustainable models of growth and a vision of economic growth which is supported by more than borrowing. Secondly, we have a job to create the public services fit for a 21st century society. We've seen a big move away from a kind of one-size-fits-all approach. We've seen a move towards personalisation. Labour was behind much of that. But we need to go further and faster to tailor services around the needs of communities. And the way that I think we need to do that is by giving people more control and responsibility for delivering those services themselves. So our challenge is to create a vision of public services that goes beyond care and delivery to engagement and empowerment. And we also have a real challenge in tackling the inequalities that for so long have scarred us and held people back. And Labour's record has been good in this area. We have focused on the least well-off. And in Newcastle, we campaign for and will be implementing a living wage for the lowest paid workers, because we know that a living wage represents dignity, respect and hope for the future. But we also know that the gap is important. And the gap is the factor that maintains the inequalities and promotes the social injustices that brought many of us into the labour movement to tackle. So we cannot simply focus on the least well off. We have to have a concept of proportional universalism in tackling inequality. And we need to have a vision of tackling inequality that doesn't just help those who need it most, but that reduces that gap between the bottom and the top. So, in short, we have to change our mindset. We have to earn the right to govern again. We must have the courage and the confidence to articulate a new vision for all that Britain can yet be. We must be the change makers of the future, not the apologists for the past.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. Our fourth panellist is Deborah Mattinson. Deborah is the director of Britain Thinks. She's worked with the Labour Party on opinion research for 30 years now, and last year published her book about the gap between the Westminster Village and the voters, entitled Talking to a Brick Wall. Deborah.
I'm not sure it's quite 30, actually. I can't bear that, but thank you anyway. So, for me, if we're looking at the state of the party, the start point is to look at the state of the electorate, because I think the two fortunes are interwoven. So I'm going to start by saying, where are voters right now? And I think there are three things I'd want to draw your attention to. The first is the national mood. And the mood nowadays is what lots of people are describing as pessimistic nationalism. What do people think? Well, 8 out of 10 think that the country is going in the wrong direction. 73% think that Britain is a soft touch for immigrants. And those two thoughts are often very closely interconnected. The mood is bleak. The second thing that actually hasn't been discussed that much lately is the growing and continuing mistrust of politicians and government. It's relentless with the public. The media are now quite quiet, but public views haven't changed since expenses. People still feel that politicians are taking them for a ride and that government doesn't do enough for them. And the new bête noire in focus groups is the career politician. People talk about that through clenched teeth. This is the person who is in it for themselves and does nothing for the voter. But the third point, and the biggest point, and all of the panellists have talked about this in different ways, is the economy. What I'm finding is that money dominates absolutely everything. 42% and 61% of people who are working class say it's now a real struggle to make ends meet. 56% of people think that it would be a big financial problem if they had to replace a major item like a washing machine. 57% are spending less on groceries. Two-thirds have either no savings at all or savings that amount to less than 1 month's salary. And in focus groups, I did focus groups this week to talk about family policy, and everything is seen through the filter of the economy. Every problem that people have comes back to that one thing. So it's there, kind of like a cloud over everybody's heads. So against that backdrop, how is Labour doing? And I think in a way, I'd ask the same question, I think that in different ways the other panellists have asked too. You know, things are going pretty badly, so why isn't Labour doing a bit better? The local elections were not awful, but they weren't great. The real problems were seen in the south, in non-urban areas, and in the middle class areas. And when I say middle class, I don't mean posh people. I mean the 7 out of 10 people who define themselves as middle class. And at Britain Thinks, we've recently done a piece of work, you can see it on our website, where we took that group and divided them into 6 segments. Only one of them, a group that we called the squeezed strugglers, who make up less than 10% of that group, give Labour a lead. So Labour is not doing well with the middle classes. Taking each of those areas and just looking at that a little bit more forensically, pessimistic nationalism. Why can't Labour do better on that? This feeling of broken Britain, there's a feeling that a lot of this is Labour's fault. And my own sense is that a lot of politicians standing up and talking about how Labour got it wrong with immigration isn't really solving the problem unless Labour comes up with some solutions. It's actually confirming the problem. Mistrust of politicians, they're all as bad as each other. Well, are they? It actually might be worse for Labour. Because in a way, logically, if you don't trust government and you don't trust politicians, that makes the case for smaller, not larger, government. One of the most striking figures in a recent poll that we've done is that just 14% think that they will get more back from public services than they pay in their lifetime. Just 14% feel that they are getting value from government. I think unless Labour can turn that round, it's going to really struggle to make a case for the kind of government that Labour would like to see. And money dominates everything. People aren't happy with cuts, but Labour is blamed for the economic problems, and that remains the case. Just 30% say that Labour would be better at managing the economy. I'm sorry, but that's how it is. So I'm moving slightly beyond my remit in the final few moments here, and I just have a few initial thoughts about what Labour needs to do to do better. And my feeling is, and the focus groups I do up and down the country bear this out, Labour is failing to get into the national conversation, and the first thing that Labour has to do is to do that. There's almost a sense that, you know, Cameron is there and he's the government, and Clegg is the opposition. And where is Ed Miliband? Labour has to win the licence to be heard again, I think. And I think that's about two things. It's partly about what Labour says. And just taking that most important issue, the economy is the most vital. If Labour can't win back its economic credentials, it can't get anywhere. I think that Labour has a fundamental problem, which is that nearly 60% of people acknowledge the need for cuts. And although there's a very small difference potentially between where Labour is and where the Tories are, very small but very significant difference, the public view is that Labour is simply opposing cuts. And I think that has to be addressed, and and I think it has to be addressed fast. The other thing is not just about what we say, but about how we say it. And my feeling is that Labour is not getting its communications right and clear at the moment. I feel that Labour is talking about people. We very often talk in a slightly geeky, jargony way, referring to voters almost as if they're lab rats, not people like us. There's this sense that there's this sort of massive gap between where Labour is and where people are, and that has to be addressed. It's about empathy, not understanding. I think that we also need to understand that that voters see politics through symbols, not through detailed narratives and policy solutions. And here you're probably all going to start throwing tomatoes at me, but we have invested a lot of time in saying that David Cameron's photo opportunities are shallow and meaningless and so on. I think he does it well. I think that he has done quite a good job of clarifying in people's minds simply and visually what he's about. And I think Labour needs to think harder how it can do that. So just moving to some final points, it's absolutely right that there's this policy review process. It's really tough at the moment, and it's better to have the right position than to have the quick position. But Labour needs to move fast, or there's a risk that there will be a settled view that Labour is irrelevant to that national conversation. And I think people need Labour now more than ever and will not forgive Labour for not being there at this time. My view is we need a dramatic shift of gear, and we need it fast.
Deborah, thank you very much for that sobering analysis that I think does absolutely set the tone for this discussion this morning. We have about 25 minutes. I'm going to invite questions. Can I urge them to be questions? I'll take them in groups of three or four and come back to the panellists. So if I can take the gentleman there first.
Morning. My name's Julian Ellaby. My question is to Deborah, mainly. I was interested in what you were saying about how Cameron comes across, but you opened up by talking about how people are very cynical still of politics. And I wondered how we can marry that up in terms of the identity that Labour or Ed should have and how we should promote that so that we don't come across as hypocritical or inappropriate.
Thank you very much. Wes at the back.
My name is Wes. My question, I thought it was really interesting when Nick talked about the gap between richest and poorest. There seemed to be a divergence of opinion in the room. And Caroline, I think, rightly drew contrast between where Labour needs to stand on things like benefits dependency and benefits lifestyles. But we seem uncomfortable or incapable as a party about talking about the excesses and the abuses of the richest. What does the panel think about Nick's proposition of talking more about reducing the gap between richest and poorest?
And Sally, who's here.
Thanks. Councillor Sally Prentice from Lambeth. I'd just like to follow up on the point that Deborah made about the sense of denial I think nationally we are in about the cuts. I think there's a strong sense in the South that Labour has wasted people's hard-earned money, yet every day you get from the National Party requests to sign petitions against cuts. So my question to Caroline is, if we were in government, we would be making cuts, and the public know that. What are our absolute top priorities, and where are we prepared to make some hard decisions?
Thank you. Let me take one more, and then I'll come back to the panel. Yes, at the back, just there. Yep, waving at me.
Stuart Madewell from the Times. Following on from what Deborah says, her argument is very similar to an article I saw on the website of Labour Uncut by Peter Watts, when he advocates that Labour should sign up to the Tories' spending totals. This will be a game changer. We should accept the spending limits imposed by George Osborne should be the basis of spending limits, just as we accepted the Tory spending limits prior to the 1997 election. What does the panel think of that?
Thank you very much. I'll come to Deborah first.
Thanks. Julian's point about David Cameron. Yes, people are cynical, and they are cynical about him, and I don't mean to imply that they think he's fantastic, but I'll give you a quote from a focus group this week that just kind of sums up the thing. They were talking, because the focus groups were about families, and they were talking about politicians and their families, and somebody said, and they all agreed in this focus group, say what you like about David Cameron, and there are lots of things about him they don't like, but he really loves those kids. And then one of them went on and said, and this was the kind of oh moment, you know, when you see those photographs of him with his kids, you know they're not just a cynical photo opportunity. You know, you have to be authentic. I'm sure that David Cameron does love his kids. It's something that they know about him. I think what Ed has to do, it's, I think Mary talked about this, the electorate has yet to get to know him. I know Ed, I know he's a lovely guy, but they don't know that. He has to find the things about himself that he wants to sort of share with the voter that will define him, and it's really important that he does that quite quickly. Shall I just pick up on a couple of other
Please
things?
Do, yes.
Sally's point about the economy, actually, and Stuart's point, I think, kind of fit together in a way. Peter Watt's article, Labour on Cut, I thought was really good, and I tweeted that I agreed with it, and I did. I don't think that he was saying Labour should agree with the Tories at all. I think what he was saying was that, you know, Labour has to move away from just simply knee-jerk opposing cuts because, you know, if Labour doesn't do that, then it has no credibility in that argument because people believe that cuts are needed and blame Labour. And until it can kind of reinforce its position in that place, it has nothing to say, and I agreed.
Nick. On the point about inequalities, one of the things that strikes me about this debate is that people really have no idea how much they're paid in comparison with other people. And part of the discourse that's lacking at the moment is a sense of how people respond to that pay differential, which is why what we're doing in Newcastle, we're going to be setting up a pay commission so that we can look at this in public, because actually it's not just the gap that creates the inequalities, it's the lack of knowledge about what that gap is. And I agree with the point that was made about symbolism. One of the reasons why the Lib Dems won control in Newcastle back in 2004 was because there was a grain of truth in their critique of the council as arrogant, out of touch, and setting high levels of council tax. That's why, in my first week, I made sure I did a walkabout in a very secure Lib Dem area to send a message that I was listening to parts of the city that we didn't have representation in. I've sent a message about council tax being low in the future. And what I'm doing at the moment is making sure that people see us as a listening council, not as a council which is taking decisions behind closed doors. And those are, for me, absolutely crucial symbols to get right in the city from day one. And I think those are the kind of symbols we need to think about for Labour in government and in opposition nationally. Thank you. Mary.
Thanks very much, Stephen. On Julian's point first, how Cameron comes across. I mean, Cameron is a terrible cynic. I mean, so much of this, as Deborah has hinted at, is image manipulation, the Huskies and so on. I mean, it's all central casting and wardrobes full of props and so on. And it is rather galling, I think, that the public seems, and the media too, the media sells all this stuff, to take it all seriously because, it's obviously in some ways either very staged managed or at worst a sort of complete fraud. And I think to try and get Ed Miliband to do that would A, be very unauthentic and B, you know, because of that, I don't think the public would buy it for a moment. But there are other ways, I think, of defining oneself as a leader. And I don't think Cameron is just, you know, sort of props and window dressing. I think he is very capable of making quick decisions that the public can identify with, and I think that's something that also Labour's lacking. Just two quick examples. One was Libya. I mean, Libya has obviously gone in a very different direction now, and I don't justify what's happening at the moment, but I think that initial humanitarian catastrophe, impending humanitarian catastrophe, and the response to it was absolutely right, and I think the public thought so. On the debit side,
his recent decision to call a Metropolitan Police inquiry into the Madeleine McCann affair strikes me as opportunism of the worst kind. So it can misfire too, but I think to acquire definition, it's not just what you look like and how much you love your kids, it's also how decisive you can be when the chips are down. The other three questions, briefly, are all about the economy in one way or another, how much individuals are worth and how much the state should spend. I think Labour needs to be clear in continuing to condemn high salaries. I think voters do have a lot of sympathy with the idea that many people are paid unjustified wages and do much better than they deserve to. On how much should be cut and how much the state spends, I thought Deborah's point was really interesting, that focus groups say government doesn't do enough for us. Well, that's the state, isn't it? The state's got a very, very poor name these days. I think Labour needs to make a much more coherent argument for the incredibly important role of the benevolent state, something that people love a great deal more than they think they do.
Thank you very much. Caroline.
I think on the how you present yourself, you know, the reality is that, you know, how many messages actually get through to the public? And my criticism of us in the past in government, because we had so many initiatives and so many messages are going on, it's really hard for people to sort of find their way through all of that to come out of it with a distinctive sense of, well, I actually know where he stands on that, or I know what that, you know, the party's saying about this. And I think that is as much about policy. We have to address that communication exchange, but also about, you know, what we represent as people. And, you know, part of it will be engineered, and all of us who are closer to, if you like, the centre of things will find that all maybe a bit little hackneyed and trite. But actually, you know, over time, the public out there don't remember the setup. They just remember what the emotion was that was left behind in their heads. And part of that is do they like this person? I think likability factor is really important. But also, do they think in terms of their own emotions and sense of what they want out of life, whether that politician and the party they represent are in tune with what they think? And it's that barometer effect, I think, that is important here. Wes's point about the rich and the poor, I you know, think, and that actually the vast majority of people in this country, increasingly over the last few years, have felt really, you know, in the middle of what they see as irresponsibility at either end of the economic scale, whether that's people with telephone number salaries or those people who think they're not doing enough to help themselves despite what the state provides them for. And so I do think it's a message at both ends. Not to be anti-success, we don't want that, you know, because we need the private sector to deliver jobs and the goods that we need to sell. But there is a balance there, and our language and how we talk about things. And I think this leads to the economy issue, and for Labour, is we need to talk about how we would fix things, because that's, in many respects, the message going forward. How we fix things to prevent what happened happening again. What are the lessons we've learned about what we would or would not do in the future? And I think if we can get that balance right, both at one, you know, rich end of the economic scale and at the other end, you know, that at least helps us to start having the conversation. And I think in all the contributions this morning is how do we get to the point that people want to listen to what we've got to say? And, you know, there are signs of recovery, but, you know, we're not quite there yet. Sally and colleagues have said about cuts. We cannot win on an anti-cuts agenda. The reality is here, whether it is the deal that's been provided to local councils or, for that matter, the spending limits set by government. I mean, it's actually not necessarily about agreeing with George Osborne. We don't have the numbers in Parliament. It's there. It's a reality. But having said that, Sally, and I'll talk to you afterwards about what the party's sending out in terms of signing up to petitions, I still think there's a value when Labour is in opposition in a local authority area to scrutinise and challenge some of the decisions Tories and Liberal Democrats are making. Because how we find those savings and those cuts can be done in different ways. What we are absolutely, you know, really not good enough at as a party
is talking about, as I said in my contribution, championing those Labour councils who do provide good value for money. It's almost like we're shy of talking about where we've made savings and where we're finding value. And when you look at polling and people are asked, when you think of a Tory council, what comes to mind? They say things like good value for money, efficiency. Now, that should be something that we should be seen as being associated with as well.
Thank you very much. Let me take some further contributions. If I can take the man in the front row here. There's a hand right at the very, very back, and the gentleman here.
Hi, Tyrone Wilson. As Deborah said, only 14% of people think they're getting their money's worth from their public services. I think a lot of that's probably to do with, over the last decade, the tabloid demonisation of those who are dependent on benefits, kind of touching on Caroline's point as well. And I'd say we need to, as a party, emphasise welfare as a means to an end again. But do the panel think there's anything, even if it is symbolic, we can do to show that we're serious on welfare reform without also being aware, kind of coming from a council estate myself, without just coming across Tory light, as a lot of the time we were seen as during the last government?
Thank you very much. There's someone right at the back, yes.
Neil Stewart. We're sat here in the TUC building. Most people, four-fifths of the population, are working in the private sector. They experience their economy as the world of work. What do people think Labour should be saying about the world of work, about workplace relations, trade union relations? It's quite clear that government are trying to stir up trouble on that side. Secondly, Scotland. First of all, we're very sorry. But what lessons, I'm asking Deborah really, what lessons can we take from what happened in Scotland? Because Alex Salmond and others were very careful to describe themselves as Social Democrats. And when Nicola Sturgeon did her victory speech, she said she was a Social Democrat before she even mentioned she was a nationalist. And other people are colonising some of these spaces. And it's demonstrating how fluid and how weak some of the traditional links, almost tribal links, that those of us who worked in the 80s and early 90s could sort of count on an irreducible 30%. That has gone. Looks like some people are holding it in the north. But if we are not holding it in Scotland and we continue to have southern discomfort, what can we do to tackle all of that?
Thanks, Neil. Yes, gentlemen here. I'm going to have to disappoint a lot of people because I think this will have to be the last one if we're going to keep to time. Sorry.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a question about the policy review. I agree with Deborah that there is a need for a dramatic and fast change of gear. If you look at the Labour website, you don't find hardly anything on that. There's no coherent description of what we are trying to do in all these policy reviews. In fact, it looks like a pretty archaic mishmash. And I just mentioned this. There's this magazine outside that talks about the policy review, and that is coming to the same conclusion. And unless we get ourselves organised properly, and a step up in gear is not possible because it's not properly organised, it's not properly run, it's not coherent.
Thank you. The man just there, David. Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, I must congratulate Nick Forbes because it's nice to see somebody new at the helm in Newcastle, and you've worked so hard for so long. Keep it going, and congratulations. My question is, all these conversations this morning have been leading towards the next general election when we don't know when it's going to be and we don't know if we're organised. Now, the coalition are on shaky ground here. Are we prepared if they go for a quick general election? Are we organised and have we got our house in order? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to come back to the panel now. Sorry that I haven't been able to take everyone, and ask the panellists to keep to 2 minutes, so don't feel the need to respond to every single point. Caroline.
Well, of course we're ready, whenever it comes. Look, you know, we have got at the moment a situation where they are establishing a fixed-term parliament and a date.
I know there's quite a lot of discussion. I'm sure there'll be discussion over the course of today about the likelihood of Cameron going earlier. But, you know, he's got a lot invested in this coalition and keeping things going as long as possible. And the other reality is they will be looking very closely at all the economic indicators. Because, let's be frank about it, what they are hoping for in terms of the pain now is the gain later, that somehow it will come through. And, you know, ultimately, no matter how much we try to plan and foresee everything, politics is also about risk as well and taking a risk. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, that's as true for the government as it is for us in opposition. So, we just have to be alert and do whatever we can. But we have got other elections, David, as well, in terms of more council elections next year and big county council ones in 2013. But, you know, some things aren't in our hand and we have to do the best we can. And I link the question to how ready we are with the point made by the gentleman about the policy review. I will take your will take your comments back. One thing I do think we need to think about, and you know, post the elections we've had, is a good time, and with what Peter's doing in terms of the party. We've been fortunate enough to have had a long period in government, and in some ways our party machinery was developed around that. Speaking from a sort of shadow cabinet perspective with my team, I think we still have to work through, given our limited resources, how we best work and gel together in terms of the party and what we provide. And that means good information that goes out to people about what's happening with the policy review or other things we're doing. I think that's a bit of a work in progress. But I think people have the chance to make these views known and to let us know as well about what you think about things, whether they're working or not. It's not for want of activity. We've done a lot of fresh ideas events, and that some of those have been really good, some have been not so good, but we need to learn from that. But I think it's how we shape ourselves as opposition at the moment, which is still a task to be achieved. On Scotland, I totally agree with Neil. I saw our friend Sarah Boyack the other day, Neil, and Sarah and I think Jim Murphy are going to be doing some work reviewing what happened in Scotland, but I think you're absolutely right. You know, none of us should think that there are no lessons for the rest of us in terms of what happened in Scotland and learning from that. And, I mean, in terms of benefits, you know, it's just really important. We've got a big debate coming up over welfare reform and with the coalition setting out their stall. I always try to think about, you know, rightly or wrongly, you know, what comes back to me from the doorsteps in my constituency about how people feel about things. Because whatever data collection we have at a national level about what is or isn't happening, who's on benefits, who's not on benefits, you know, you go to streets and communities and they tell you about the people who are working on the side, who they've reported to the job centre, and then they never hear anything about anything being done. Now, that's obviously anecdotal, and I'm not saying we should have policy based on the anecdotes of the streets of Don Valley, but what I would say to you, if that's the feeling out there and they don't think we're addressing that, that becomes, you know, part of what they think is the truth and the reality. And the truth is, some of that is a reality.
Thank you. Mary.
If I could start with your question as well, I think it's very interesting, the blurred line between myth and reality. Ivan Lewis was saying in his speech the other day that Labour's characterised as the party of the poor, of benefit scroungers, of immigrants and so on. And I think there's a risk for Labour in becoming too apologetic about all this. There are real limits on what you can do, certainly on immigration. By the time you've listened to business, by the time you've listened to the university's argument, the fact that Labour, by the end, had a pretty good, pretty sound policy on immigration, I think what you have to do is to look at the perceptions of Labour in a slightly different way. You need to do what Caroline's suggesting, look much more clearly at a fairer system of employment, and you need to build a great deal more social housing so there isn't all this pressure on housing. People have nowhere to live, their kids don't, so that somehow gets focused on immigration. So I think Labour just has to stop buying so much into that mythology and to change the terms of debate. Lessons from Scotland, I think very briefly, be clear, be inspiring, tell people what they want to hear, do some of it, and don't sit around waiting for victory to fall into your lap, because it won't. I think Labour's taken the second lesson on board very well. The first is still a work in progress. I agree that the policy review is far too Delphic. People have no idea what's happening. Tony Blair got his sort of remorse in early with his Clause 4 moment. And from then on, there was a sort of clear direction of travel. I mean, we're not going to get a great package of pre-made, ready-made policies, but I think to keep the public in the dark for very much longer, as Deborah suggested earlier, is quite a dangerous business. On the general election, yes, I suppose the coalition could collapse under the weight of its own contradictions. Labour has to be prepared for that. Caroline says it is. I hope she's right.
Nick. Thanks, Mary.
We are a party that cares. We are all people who care very deeply about other people. That's what makes us different from other parties. And we find it very comfortable to talk amongst ourselves about the value of and importance of benefits. What we don't do so much is talk about the values and importance of work. And I think if we can promote work and getting people into employment as one of the things which will not only drive our economy, but is good for people, rather than simply relying on the state to support people, we need to change our language around this and promote work. And on Neil's point around trade unions, one of the things that we did in Newcastle was develop a concordat between ourselves and the trade unions, setting out key points of principle that we wanted to work around. And if anybody wants a copy of it, please let me know and I'll pass it on. On the policy point, we developed a manifesto for these local elections, and we had lots of Labour Party people sat in rooms talking with great earnestness about equality and cooperation and fairness and values and so on. And I went back and I took in some of the results from our voter ID work that said actually what people are most concerned about is antisocial behaviour and whether their streets are clean. And so let's actually not forget that even under socialism, the bins need to be emptied. So it's really important that when we talk about policy, we start with what people want to see, not what our starting point is. There's a point here around organisation in preparation for the next general election, whenever it comes. We need to do more as a party around organisation. This was the first set of elections in Newcastle where we had proper, comprehensive organisation in place and were pretty ruthless in its application, and we've seen the benefit of that. But I know, even in my part of the country, that our organisation is patchy and often our infrastructure is weak. So we need to do more to get that in place now and start building our capacity now, rather than simply waiting for David Cameron to call the election. And I've been clear with my colleagues, we will fight every set of local elections as if the council is marginal, whatever the size of our majority is. Above all, I think, the issue for Labour is we need to look as though we know what we're doing. We need to look like we have a plan, because we need for people to have confidence in us. We can sit and debate around our values and our principles and our policies as much as we like, but if people don't have confidence in us, they won't vote for us.
Thanks, Nick. Deborah.
Thanks. I'd love to get into trade unions and workplace, but I don't think I could do it in 2 hours, let alone 2 minutes, so I'm going to go straight to the question about the 14%, the only 14% who think that they get value, and it was actually value from public services was the question. I maybe didn't make that clear enough. Which I think means it's not particularly about welfare, although, of course, it does mean that people just don't feel that that government is working for them. And there was a real irony there, which was when we look at the data, the less well-off people are, the less likely they are to think that they get something good out of public services. So there's a massive challenge there. Recent survey also, 55% think public services are getting worse. And my feeling is, and I'm going to try and link this in with the policy review thing, yes, I think it does need to be very, very much clearer, and I agree with that. And for me, the question that should be at the heart of the policy review for Labour is, you know, how do you persuade people that public services can work for them and that government can work for them? And if we can't persuade on that, then we can't persuade. And just the only other thing to pick up on, I think, was the Scottish question. And I just think there's a chilling lesson there You know, I don't think that what happened in Scotland was about nationalism or about independence. I think that, you know, when the question was asked, when Neil asked the question, he answered it himself, really. I think it was about being complacent. I think it was about assuming that those tribal links, as you described them, were going to deliver. You know, they didn't. And the lesson there is never, ever, ever take the voter for granted.
Thank you very much indeed, Deborah.